Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. Glad you're with us today. Our goal is to bring you credible and valid information and insights from diverse members of our community. Central Coast Voices wants to address how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community and how we look at the long-range ramifications of change in our society, or in some cases, how we look at our fear of change or lack of change, because that's kind of what we're going to talk about today. Because our topic today is artificial intelligence, a promise for the future, or a question of ethics. And for those of you who may not have thought about this, we're looking at artificial intelligence not as a pure science topic at all. But in a lot of cases, we deal with it as pure science. A lot of our life, our cell phones, how our GPS in our car works, how we do online banking, how we get annoyed at online banking, and are really things that we do that somewhat depend on artificial intelligence. And how we define artificial intelligence, we will hope to sort out today, because it comes with risks, and hopefully eventually it will give us the ability to sort out those risks in a way that makes us feel comfortable with it and not feel fearful. So there's a rise of artificial intelligence as we do things. There's a myriad of implications and complications from it. And today we're going to talk about it, but we're going to talk about it, I must interject first, as not pure science, but to some extent we're going to talk about it as a philosophical topic, because I have Dr. Ryan Jenkins, who's Associate Professor of Philosophy and a Senior Fellow of the Ethics and Emerging Sciences Group at Cal Poly, and Professor Keith Abney, who's also a Cal Poly professor and lecturer on philosophy and religious scholar, who also is a Senior Fellow of the Ethics and Emerging Sciences Group at Cal Poly. In other words, we are going to deal with a scientific topic from a philosophical standpoint, and I think that's probably the best way to deal with it. And if you don't think that's the case, stick around, because I might change your mind, as my guests might do also. If you do think that's the case, then that's probably why you're listening already anyway. You can give us a call if you'd like. The phone number is 805-781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. Some of you are tired of me saying this, but I will remind you that the earlier in the program you call, the more time we have to really address what your concerns or observations are, even though I realize a lot of you prefer to call for some reason in the last 10 or 12 minutes of the program. So we want to put you on as part of the discussion if we possibly can. Gentlemen, so I guess we all have a perception of what we think artificial intelligence is. I would invite either or both of you to try and define it for us. I believe you can define it, but can you give us a definition that becomes understandable for those of us who are laymen, which is everybody?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Artificial intelligence is challenging sometimes to define. It can be frustrating because the label gets attached to a lot of things that don't really merit the label. It's become very buzzy in the tech community to say that your product involves artificial intelligence when that's probably not appropriate. But properly speaking, and I think what we'll be talking about today, are systems that can ingest data that they're given and can abstract patterns from that data and can make inferences and then make predictions. And the most impressive kinds of artificial intelligence continually learn to update what their predictions will be. And the hope is that they get better and better at making predictions about the future within whatever domain is relevant to them, whatever data that they're working on.
Okay. So I want to interject a question into what you said, which is, I think you said some very important things. But I had not really thought about this from a standpoint of we're dealing with an idiom, if you will, that will have the ability to self-regulate its own information. In other words, what it digests, what it discards, what it continues to use. I don't think the GPS in my car is currently doing that, but maybe it is and I don't know about it. And to look at a topic that's bothersome for some people, I'm not quite sure what the autopilot system in the 737 MAX aircrafts have been grounded does with that regard, because based upon the fact that I'm in the travel and tourism industry as my day job, I pay attention to that, and I'm wondering whether or not that indeed is a dilemma of artificial intelligence or that's pure science.
Well, this is Keith, by the way. I would phrase things slightly differently than Ryan, just because he built in a desirable feature, which is the ability to update, which I don't think is necessary for an artificial intelligence. I mean, it's, again, desirable. Basically, an artificial intelligence, why do we have any kind of intelligence? It basically is the idea that we're trying to achieve what's called a cognitive goal, right? Okay. We want to figure out how to do something, right? We have purposes. And so an artificial intelligence is just something that's capable of achieving a cognitive goal artificially, right? Not by means of evolution. And so an artificial intelligence essentially is something that can take, as Brian said, data, inputs, right? And can then achieve some cognitive goal. This is what I want to do, or want to fit more specifically what I want to figure out, right? Now, ideally, it would work better if it could continually update, right, its model, its way of figuring that out when it gets new information. But that's, strictly speaking, not required. You could have a really sophisticated AI, right, that can't ever update, but it can take into account a trillion different things and come up with some pretty interesting things, but it could never update. That still wouldn't be as good as one that could take into account a trillion different things and then update, right?
Yeah. I guess I'm trying to look at my notes. Yeah, this is – Ryan, I think this is one of the comments that you made. When we looked at the part of the question, the things we send out as a questionnaire to you guys with for some input, what you see is the questions are the dilemmas that come from people. You referenced that which way should a driverless car turn in the, quote, trolley problem? The fact that that comes up for you as an inference leads me to believe we probably need to define the trolley problem and talk about it, because that's pretty much at the top of your list of questions that you face.
Sure, it's a common question. This is making me wish that I'd trademarked the trolley problem and then to collect royalties on it. I'd be sitting pretty by now. The trolley problem is a problem that dates back several decades in academic philosophy to the late 60s, early 70s. And it's a thought experiment that goes like this. You are standing next to some trolley tracks, and you see that there's a runaway trolley. The driver is passed out, he's slumped over the wheel, or there's no driver at all. The brakes have failed. Add in whatever details you need to make the trolley an unstoppable runaway trolley. You look down the track and you notice that there are five people stuck on the track. Maybe they're people who are napping. Maybe some evil villain has tied them there. Maybe they're all workmen who are wearing headphones, so they're not going to hear the trolley approaching. Again, fill in the details however you need to. You quickly realize that if nothing changes, the trolley is going to plow into these five people and almost certainly kill them. However, your luck is that you're standing next to a switch, and you can switch the trolley track you can divert the trolley so that rather than running into the five people, it will switch onto a side track. And just as you're getting optimistic about this option, you realize that down the side track, there's one person standing there. So now the dilemma is this. You can do nothing, and you can watch the trolley careen into these five people and almost certainly kill them. Or you can pull the switch, and you can save these five people, but at the same time, you're condemning one person to death. So you're saving one, but killing one. Or so you're saving five people, but killing one person. And this is a classic. It's become a classic problem in philosophy, and it's sprouted a cottage industry of people that work on different versions of the trolley problem. There are over 1,000 articles that reference it, and several hundred that reference the trolley problem specifically with regards to autonomous vehicles or driverless cars. Because a couple of years ago, people realized that the same basic question applies, or that we can use this thought experiment at least as a metaphor for the kinds of decisions that driverless cars will make. So you can imagine a driverless car is driving down the road, and there are five people in front of it, and the five people won't move. But luckily, the car itself can swerve out of the way. But whichever way it swerves, it's probably going to hit one person and condemn one person to death. So should the car make that decision? And you can see that in this case, the car, we're supposing it's guided by artificial intelligence, is making a decision that's analogous to you in the original thought experiment. Now, the thought experiment has all kinds of philosophical implications, and the answer that you give is supposed to reveal something about your philosophical commitments, your commitments to what moral theory is correct. And for that reason, it helps us plumb the depths of the ethical considerations that come into play when we're designing artificially intelligent systems. That the decisions that we program into them, or the things that they decide to do, the things that they infer, the things that they learn to do, will surely have ethical implications in the same way that the original trolley problem does.
So an artificial intelligence that works strictly on scientific input that's been programmed into it may say, okay, there's five people on this track. There's one person on this track. One is less person harmed than five, so therefore we turn to the one.
Right, exactly.
Okay. As you were saying that, it occurred to me, or the five people in the middle could be people who all are defiantly standing there to make a point for some reason and willing to die making that point. How does the artificial intelligence know the difference?
Right.
Within the realm of artificial intelligence, is there any way that an artificial intelligence could extrapolate that information to make that kind of decision?
Seems unlikely. if it's just seeing five people, or more likely nowadays probably just seeing five objects in front of it, mm-hmm. It's probably not going to have access to that information. If we project out into the future, if we really put on our science fiction caps, and those five people have declared their intentions on social media or something mm-hmm. like that, then it's conceivable that an artificial intelligence that has access to unbounded data, the kind of data that we generate every day about our intentions and our desires, that kind of artificial intelligence might very well have access to that kind of data. But then I think the question becomes harder, not easier.
Right. As a matter of fact, yeah. I mean, it's not actually a stretch. You decided to post this on Facebook and it has access. But I think what Ryan's point is that needs to be emphasized is this reveals your philosophical, in particular, your moral theory commitments. So to take a different version of the trolley problem, suppose your autonomous vehicle cannot help but hit one of two motorcycles immediately ahead of it. In one lane is a motorcyclist with no helmet. In the other lane is a motorcyclist with a helmet. Which one should it choose? Because, of course, if you hit the one with the helmet, you're less likely to cause death. On the other hand, you're saying, I should hit the law-abiding one and not the one who's breaking the law.
Right. The person who's behaving responsibly okay. ends up being punished in a sense.
Exactly.
Okay. At what point looking at this again, the good news is when I say on this program sometimes from a philosophical standpoint, and that gets me thrown out of the room, the good news is I'm dealing with two professors of philosophy, mm-hmm. so you don't think asking it from a philosophical standpoint. Is at what point does someone that's working on that artificial intelligence decide we need to put all of the variables, we need to put the 85 billion variables into the software to make sure that kind of decision is made, but it's more likely that the equipment or the device is going to be more likely to fail on a regular basis based upon too many paths of information. So are we looking at the artificial intelligence issue. But to some extent, should we be looking at the philosophical bent of the person who's designing the device in the first place and decide whether or not they have passed the test for good intentions and well thought out reasoning? Because we don't want, it's Mussolini could keep the trains on time. I don't want Mussolini type people necessarily deciding who gets to survive in an accident like that, even though they may end up being the most astute scientist in the group. Right. And my hunch is that's what the two of you deal with on a regular basis. Okay.
Mussolini types?
No, the question. The question. I don't know. It's I'll have to look at the. I'll look at the faculty roster in your department. Okay.
The whole point, is that we're trying to do, in a sense, help professionals try to understand their own ethics. Every time an engineer, every time a programmer makes a decision, this is what ought to be in the program. This is what ought not to. This is what the resulting robot ought to do. This is what it ought not to be able to do. They're doing ethics, whether they realize it or not. They're saying this is the way the world ought to be, or this is the way the world ought not to be. It's part of their practice. Now, whether they're doing it consciously or not is a whole different matter. We would like to help them be a little more conscious of what they're already doing.
Right. I heard a colleague put it very well once when he said that engineers and technologists are people who, by definition, want to make the world a better place. So what does moral philosophy have to offer that kind of enterprise? Well, the answer is that moral philosophers are people who have been specializing for about 2,300 years in thinking about how to make the world a better place, what kinds of actions make the world a better place, and what kinds of risks there might be that are often overlooked. So we humbly suggest that we have some advice to offer when we're thinking about ways to change the world for the better.
Right.
Okay. I want to remind folks, we are with you today. This is Central Coast Voices, and we are talking about artificial intelligence. Please no snide comments about whether or not the intelligence in the room is artificial or real. But it's really a philosophical topic that we'd like to share with you if you'd like to be part of the discussion. The phone number is 805-781-3875. That's 781-3875. Okay, so by definition, I would assume a lot of what you deal with is based upon the historical evolution of technology. What would the two of you, and it may be different for both of you, consider to be the first thing we've had in our society that would be truly classified as artificial intelligence?
Ooh, that's tough. It depends.
I'm actually surprised that's not a regular question. Yeah,
it's been imagined in science fiction for a long time. You could go back to, say, Frankenstein, the first example of some kind of intelligence that was created by humans that wasn't natural in that sense. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's Mary Shelley, right? Maybe she owns the title there. But I think artificial intelligence, the study of it, Keith, you probably know more about this than I do. The study of it came to prominence in computer science in the 50s, yes. I would say. That was the sort of first wave of enthusiasm. And since then, I heard it described, the history described by saying that it's gone through successive waves of enthusiasm and then troughs of pessimism as some advance has been made. And then computer scientists have hit a hurdle and realized that it's a lot more difficult than we thought originally. If you read these papers from the 50s, they're contemplating having thinking machines in, a decade or two. But I think we're in one of these waves of enthusiasm right now. And I think that that's justified because you see phenomenal advances that have been made in the last couple of years. But
and public radio stations don't want to talk about it.
but there are still lots of reasons to be skeptical.
Okay. Keith, Ryan kind of implies that you have a better history on this than he does.
Well,
I don't think your age is about the same.
In part, it depends on what you're talking about. I mean, they found in a shipwreck an ancient Greek mechanism called an antikythera, or some, I'm not even sure how you pronounce it, that was able to calculate time. I mean, 2,000 years ago. In a sense, that was an artificial intelligence. The contemporary kind of beginning of it, I think, really started in the 1930s with John von Neumann and work he did. And then in the 1940s with a legendary figure named Alan Turing, who came up with a Turing test, so-called, to be able to determine when an artificial intelligence would be able to count as a person, in effect. And so his so-called Turing test basically said that if you, say, had a radio interview, right, okay. And you had one who was a human being and one that was an artificial intelligence, right, could you reliably determine, right, without paying attention to the voice or the appearance, right? Could you reliably determine which one was the human and which one was the AI? And if not, then that would count as a person. That was Turing's test. Now, there are lots and lots of work since saying, well, Turing's test might not have been the best test, but that was kind of the influential beginning of the major discussion of it in the late 1940s, 1950s.
Okay. And predecessor of Turing, you mentioned?
John von Neumann.
John Neumann. And how did he fit in this process?
Well, he did a lot of work in game theory and kind of the general theory of computing that would lead to the idea that artificial intelligences were possible, I guess. Basically, he helped in, this is an overstatement, but helped develop the invention of computer programming. And since that's essentially what we think of an artificial intelligence as, it's an algorithm, right, that in principle, an algorithm is just a series of instructions, a series of steps, right? You follow it, you get the input, and out comes your cognitive goal, right, what you were trying to figure out. And so that can be really simple, right? Add two and two, you get.
Hopefully right? Four, okay.
Right? Yeah. Or it can be, from our minds, incredibly complicated.
Okay. Because I would suggest to you that getting two and two to get four may be handy to have.
Mm-hmm.
But I would suggest that maybe the issue of whether or not there's an artificial intelligence will be whether or not the entity involved in that that's not human can explain to me why I care.
Sure.
Okay.
And so that would get us to artificial general intelligence.
Okay.
I suppose.
Good point. Wait, okay, so that's AGI, and we actually talked about it earlier because I wasn't – the definition of AGI was something that we want to talk about. Mm-hmm. Let's see. We have Bill in Arroyo Grande. Hold on a second. Bill in Arroyo Grande. Greetings. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I've got a more generalized question. I think it was Descartes who said that I think, therefore I am. When machines are doing all of our thinking, what's the purpose of humanity? And what's the purpose of education?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, I love that question myself. I think that some people are sort of plotting that trajectory into the future where we're offloading more and more of our thinking and more important decisions that require very difficult thought to machines. And if you think about a world where machines are doing all of our thinking for us, and maybe a related world, a nearby world where they're doing a lot of our work for us, there's a legitimate question to ask what will be left for us. Philosophers back to Aristotle and Plato have said that the good human life is a life of contemplation. Well, if that's the case, then why would we want to outsource all of our contemplation to machines? Why would we not want to keep any of that for ourselves?
Bill, it's a very good point because I have something to interject here too because I have a wife who just retired as a school teacher. I would suggest to you that she's decided at this point that she would rather have more leisure time and recreational time than time to work and think. And if you don't know this, my wife is a mathematician, so it's kind of a wonder why in the world she wouldn't want to do that all the time because either people either love mathematics or they avoid it. But go ahead.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. Oddly, that reminds me. Oddly enough, Descartes also only engaged in philosophy for about 1 week out of the year, and only tried to engage in original thought for about 1 day out of the year. That was so.
I didn't know that.
So even Descartes kept thinking at arm's length.
Okay. Well, I would profess to you though, in my mind, as you say that, he might have spent the rest of the year recovering from the strain of the thinking, and therefore, if we had an artificial intelligence that could make it less stressful, he could use up a lot of that week, that 1 week he was doing the other to recreate.
Okay.
All right. Does that work, Bill?
Yeah, I guess.
Okay. Okay.
All right. Thanks.
Yeah, and my hunch is I'll hear from you later as to why you think I'm ridiculous, but it's okay. Anyway,
all right.
Thanks, Bill.
I appreciate
it. Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for the record, I'm not picking on my guest. That's actually somebody I've known for quite some time, and he's a regular caller to the program. And when he's not calling in, he sends me emails with information too, which is helpful to have. But that brings up an interesting question, because if one is only doing pure science for the challenge of pure science, then yes, at some point you may feel like if everything's been solved, I don't have any purpose anymore, and I'm just going to go crawl in a hole. Another person might say, gee, if everything's been solved, I now have the ability to spend the rest of my days on vacation. Did I save enough money to just go on vacation? And has anybody come up with a self-driving car that'll get me where I want to go without me having to pay attention to it? That's an interesting way to look at that.
I'll just say quickly that science fiction is replete with examples of stories like this, where we invent a future where all of our doing and our thinking is handed over to machines. And the picture that they seem to paint almost all the time is an unenviable picture of human life. Two of these stories, one is called With Folded Hands, mm-hmm. where humanity is placed under the forceful but benevolent control of an alien race that protects us and does all of our labor for us. And the other story, which is absolutely phenomenal, is called The Machine Stops, which paints 1912, I think, paints a remarkably prescient picture of the future, where we have things like video calling and an internet and voice-controlled houses that do all of our work for us. And the picture that it paints, again, of what life is like is stultifying and uninteresting and utterly superficial. And this is one reason why I love going through science fiction, because it's often the place where we're free to explore, again, what the world would really be like with some of these inventions.
The artificial intelligence we're talking about, it seems like from my first question to you is like, what was the first device or what was the first way we define this? It still seems like it's quasi-undefinable, which to some extent, I guess that's why we're talking to philosophers today and not pure scientists, because the pure scientists wanted to be real black and white, and it's binary code, and it all fits together from that standpoint. My hunch is that the two of you deal with infinite shades of gray as opposed to black and white. Now, for the record, I will tell you that my daughter has said to me, or I thought my daughter said to me once, that I deal with infinite shades of gray. And when I said that in front of her one time, she's an adult and she's actually a science teacher, and she said, no, that's not what I meant. And that may not be what I said. And I said, well, what did you say? She said, I said you deal with too many shades of gray. And that's, as we're talking, that does fit for me as part of the conversation. And that is, are we striving for the challenge of doing something that actually fits a good definition of artificial intelligence? Is there any need for it other than the pleasure of doing it?
Well, sure. We develop artificial intelligence to make our lives easier and better, just like any other technology. At least that's the goal. And, of course, to make money. And so to kind of connect this back to a previous comment and to a previous comment you made, we're trying to achieve cognitive goals, but it's not so much that it's indefinable, it's just really complicated, in part because human intelligence is complicated, and human intelligence is always kind of our lodestone, right? The place that we start when we say, when we think about artificial intelligence, we don't think about the artificial intelligence that's subhuman very much, right? Where it's dumber than human. What most of the worry about is where it has, in various narrow, specific cognitive goals, met or surpassed human intelligence, and the number of places where it's met or surpassed human intelligence is, well, that increases every year. And so from an economic perspective, if you have a particular cognitive goal, whether it's figuring out how to multiply two 17-digit numbers together, AI figured that one out with a calculator long, you know, better than human 70 years ago, mm-hmm. or how to drive a car down a street safely. Well, they're working on that one right now, right? Whenever that particular goal can be achieved better and more cheaply than a human figuring it out, well, there's going to be pressure from the market to have humans not be the ones doing the figuring it out anymore.
There needs to be a value. There needs to be enough people who perceive a value for there to be a market for it.
Sure.
You know, Ben & Jerry's has probably made enough ice cream flavors that that Ben & Jerry thought, or their flavor chemists thought, were really terrific. Hmm. And then they discovered that they couldn't find six people across the country that really wanted to buy that.
Mm-hmm.
That struggle seems to be a lot of what it is, because as you're speaking about this, my thought is, if I could afford a Tesla S, I would really not care if it had the ability to self-drive, because I'm going to buy that car because I enjoy driving it and I enjoy the fact that it's an electric car and not using fossil fuel. So that balancing act as to value versus need, my hunch is a good portion of what you guys talk about when there's not somebody listening to you on the radio. And how do you sort it out?
Well, I think that there are some considerations that help explain – that consideration helps explain why artificial intelligence has come to prominence in some of the places that it has. Finance is one that comes to mind. So finance is an industry that is ruthlessly competitive, and most of the stock trades that take place on Wall Street today are handled by machines that are making decisions a couple thousandths in, you know, a thousandth of a second or a millionth of a second that can outpace and outcompete any decision that a human trader would ever make. So it does make a lot of sense why artificial intelligence has sprung up in some sectors and why in other sectors it has to be, say, publicly funded or funded with private donations or something like that, because the market demand is just not there, even if it would do a lot of good in those industries.
The example you use as far as like stock trading and finance, my first thought is I would almost perceive that as not being artificial intelligence. I would perceive that as just having enough room on the hard drive on the computer that's running it to look at every possible scenario until it just sorts out what is the best scenario, which we still may be able to argue with five or six times. But that would really just be a form of number crunching. And I'm wondering if that's really what's brought us to this point with artificial intelligence, and that is the amount of memory in my cell phone right now is the size of a hard drive when I was dealing with a computer in the Navy in 1971, is such that, I mean, you could have turned the hard drive that we had on a ship to handle inventory of parts into a small apartment. It was just a large drum hard drive. And what the limitation was with that kind of technology was there was really no way physically to digest the data and spit it back out the way a hard drive a hard drive on a computer now, or a non-hard drive intelligence or information source. So are we really creating an intelligence issue, or are we just finding better ways and faster ways to digest raw data that happens fast enough that everybody doesn't fall asleep or die before they get the answer to the question?
Well, I think it's an intelligence issue. I think you're running together two different things. So an analogy might help. Artificial intelligence may not achieve its cognitive goals in the same way that we do, right? But it's absolutely achieving cognitive goals. And the fact that it doesn't do it the same way that your brain does it seems to me irrelevant. I mean, think of flying, right? Evolution evolved things that could fly. They use light bones, muscles, wings. We figured out how to artificially fly. Gosh, the way we artificially fly doesn't use bones, muscles, right? Wings, but not ones that flap, mm-hmm. right? But it sure seems correct to call it flying, right? Traveling, having something heavier than air travel through the air, right? Yeah.
as you're saying that, and I understand where you're going with that, and the thought that comes to mind also is that the being that flew first or was flying long before we knew how to fly had no intelligent ability to understand why that worked or how it worked. It was a natural reaction.
Of course.
I mean, I don't – so how did the first bird that flew or first insect that flew figure out, oh, I need to flap my wings to move? It became a trial and error situation. So my hunch is we're just doing a tremendous amount of really fast trial and errors as we sort out artificial intelligence questions.
Yeah, so there's one thing – I mean, so this may get to a question you want to bring up next, but does the artificial intelligence – does it have awareness, self-awareness? Is it aware that it's an artificial intelligence? Well, that's an entirely separate issue and one that for now I think the answer is uniformly no, for now, right? When – and will that change? Well – I've written about that.
That may be the riskiest part of it, and we'll get back to that in a minute. You know, don't go away from that. But I also don't want to keep Paul waiting. So, Paul from San Luis Obispo, you're on the air. Thanks for your patience.
Yeah, perfect segue into my question, you guys. Thanks for having some philosophy on the radio. It's nice to hear. Opening up the question to a little more of a metaphysical point of view. And the nature of the reality around or the potential for feeling with computers or lack thereof and heart and soul and things that are a little less tangible and quantifiable on the plane of worldly reality as you've mostly been speaking. I'm wondering if you could address that.
Gentlemen, jump in.
Sure. So I waved my hand at this a little bit earlier. I'm a pretty hard skeptic when it comes to consciousness in machines. And part of that, I think that's almost entirely a strong intuition that I have, that there's something unique about organic biology and, say, carbon biology that makes consciousness the sole purview of beings like us and not one that we could create in a machine. When you think about the kinds of sensations that we can experience, when you think about, say, the way that we think about morality, when we think about our obligations to do the right thing, or when your parents raise you from a very early age to put yourself in someone else's shoes or to apply the golden rule and harness this capacity that we have of moral imagination to imagine what it's like to be someone else. And your parents sit you down and they ask you, how would you feel if, you know, someone did that to you? Those kinds of capacities, it strikes me as very implausible to think that they'll be instantiated in a machine anytime soon. And I stand to be proven wrong. I might be terrified if I contemplate what it would be like to be proven wrong on that question. But I'm a very hard skeptic when it comes to that. It doesn't mean that we won't have artificial intelligence that's extremely sophisticated, but it does mean that there are some things that are unique to our biology and our quote-unquote wetware that mean that consciousness for now is one thing that humans can plant our flag in and not feel threatened on.
Okay, so no robots are going to take over in terms of consciousness at this point.
Yeah, I wouldn't let that keep you up at night.
I disagree.
No.
Okay, well, okay, we have some disagreement in the room, so hang on. Okay, anyway, Keith. Right.
Oh, the brief version is that whether or not there is a soul in the traditional sense, I think. Not current. I certainly agree with Ryan's assessment of current technology. It's not going to happen immediately unless Google has a research program that I'm completely oblivious to. But I think eventually robots could absolutely have consciousness. And I have an argument to this effect called the piecemeal replacement argument. So that imagine we replace one neuron in your brain with an artificial replacement, right? And mm-hmm. we ask, are you still you? And you go, mm-hmm. yeah, of course, right? So then we replace yep. the second one, right? Are you still you? Yeah, of course, right? And we do this a trillion more times.
This old right? song and dance again.
right. Now, can we do this anytime soon? No, right? But in principle, is it possible? Sure. So now you have a completely artificial brain, right? And we can say the rest of you is still flesh and blood, but does anyone think the rest of you matters, right? So then we keep piecemeal replacing you until you're 100% robot.
Like cloning a hard drive.
Probably a little more complicated.
Well, yeah.
But yeah. So I tend to think it is possible. Technically extraordinarily difficult, yeah, but possible.
And okay. then how does that affect reincarnation if you happen to be a Hindu?
Well, I'm not a Hindu specialist, but I mean, I tend to think reincarnation is absolutely possible without venturing any opinion whatsoever on the plausibility or implausibility of Hinduism.
That's just like a rhetorical statement.
Wait, we're dealing with philosophers. Even rhetorical statements yeah. get answers.
We can't distinguish rhetorical
exactly.
and
exactly.
Yeah.
We
yeah.
take them all seriously.
Good job, guys.
Okay, thanks for the call, Paul.
For Cal Poly, but they haven't given me a call, so
okay.
maybe I'll meet you guys one day.
Thank you. Thanks for the call.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Keith, I will, as you were saying that, it occurred to me, the variable that's not in your hypothesis there mm-hmm. is whether or not that only works if another artificial intelligence can decide what needs to be replaced in your human brain in order to make the process work. So, I mean, at what example? I mean, we are all adults in the room. I think we're all adults in the room. I have a 3-year-old grandchild. She is more fascinating to me than my own child was at 3 because I was too busy being a parent when my own child was 3. As a grandparent, I can be a better spectator and enjoyer of the process. On a regular basis, I think about the fact, my gosh, this is a very bright child that's missing a tremendous amount of reasoning skills that evolve over time. Okay. So where did they come from, or are they already in her brain? They just haven't been, the right paths haven't been tied together. So to me, that becomes as much of the topic is what part of this process is the evolution of what we already have, and what part of this process is some kind of new invention that we should really be scared about?
The short answer is both. I mean,
It's an hour radio program. I'd like the longer answer.
Well, that's all the time we have.
Well, your daughter or any human being both has genetic encoding, right, that helps regulate the development of all parts of the body and the functioning thereof, including obviously the brain. So some part of her thinking ability is genetically built in. But the whole achievement of human culture, right, is to have a great deal of accumulated knowledge, of intelligence, right, that you don't have to, well, carry as part of your own hardware, right? You can access it as needed, right? And there's been an explosion for a long, long, I mean, so the invention of writing was a huge technological breakthrough here. Now, there's this cultural stuff that I can access whenever I need to just by going and reading this book, right? And now we have the internet. And so that's another tremendous leap forward. And if folks like Elon Musk are to be believed, the next step will be, well, we will begin to merge our brain, right? With an artificial intelligence, what he calls neural lace. He thinks the AIs will end up doing all of our thinking for us, and the only way forward is for us to, well, kind of join them, right? by linking our brains to them. I have no idea if he's correct or not. Again, I tend to think he promises technologically things in a relatively short framework that he can't possibly deliver. Like he says he's going to have level 5 self-driving cars next year. Nobody believes him. Fully autonomous.
Yeah.
But actually, come to think of it, the kind of Neuralace approach that he's pioneering seems very similar to the argument that you just gave.
Yeah. So my point is, his time frame is crazy. His end point, I don't think, is crazy at all.
Well, there's a lot of people who would think that everybody that's preoccupied with that question is maybe crazy, and it may go back to Ryan's intrigue with science fiction. And that is that maybe for a lot of these folks that are doing this, maybe for the two of you and how you look at this, the more absurd you can make the discussion, the more successful the challenge for information might be for both of you.
But, of course, I knew I was in enemy territory when I walked in here, and the T-shirt on the wall says no robots and no algorithms.
So it does.
I think that has to do with live radio. I don't know. Anyway, forgot about that T-shirt up there. By the way, I think it's part of one of the giveaways for during pledge drive. So I'm not quite sure the origin of the shirt, and I apologize for not knowing the origin of the shirt. And I'm also sorry for putting it in your line of sight while you're sitting here trying to have a conversation with us. You briefly glossed over artificial intelligence and artificial general intelligence that are definable in as two different items. Can you clarify for that? Okay, actually. And Keith, by the way, who brought it up, is now going to just throw it over to Ryan, which means he doesn't want to talk about it. Okay,
no, go ahead. Happy to.
He's being egalitarian with the distribution of time.
Okay.
So a lot of the artificial intelligences with which we're familiar are what's called a narrow intelligence or weak intelligence. And what that means is that they can
be...
Most
of my friends.
Yeah, another weak intelligence over here. It means that they're, even if they're fantastically impressive in what they can accomplish, they're restricted to a very narrow domain. So some examples of this, Deep Blue, the artificial intelligence that beat Garry Kasparov at chess in the late 90s, is incredibly impressive at playing chess. It can play chess better than any human can play chess, but it can't check your grammar as well as Microsoft Word can check your grammar, and it can't plot the route from the studio back to my house when I leave here. So for those kinds of tasks, I rely on separate artificial intelligences that are specific to just those domains. So those are called weak or narrow intelligences. And for some time, the Holy Grail has been, if it's not a conscious machine, the Holy Grail is a general intelligence, which is an artificial intelligence that is as good as a human at any task that you might give it, including conversation, including playing chess, or plotting directions across a map, or looking at a brain scan and trying to detect a tumor. So any kind of task that a human might want to accomplish.
As you're saying this, what I'm thinking about is how do we get that intelligence to also tell me what the best chocolate ice cream is?
Well, that would
and
be...
I don't mean that sarcastically, because right away you're saying if you want it to be able to do everything, there may be some things that are just physically impossible because they require some kind of technological taste bud system that hasn't been designed yet.
That's a good example.
Sorry, my recurring theme is ice cream. I'm sorry.
That's fine. It's a hot day. I suspect that for some subjective questions like that, some philosophers might say, myself included, just to sort of go off the cuff here, they might say there's no objective answer to a question like that. Who's the greatest painter of all time? Or is Tom Brady better than Joe Namath, or something like that? So these are the kinds of things that people will argue about.
Yes.
And there's not, yeah, in my head, I'm not a Tom Brady fan, but in my head, I was thinking, yeah, he probably is. But you see the kinds of questions I'm gesturing at, the kinds of things that don't have objective answers. Whereas there probably is an objective answer about if I give a list of symptoms to an artificial intelligence, it will tell me what condition I have. And that has a right answer. And so those are the kinds of things that we're interested in developing AI to solve for us.
I actually think AI will be able to solve some of the issues even Ryan brought up, or your to address your question. But again, it may just not do it in exactly the same way as us. So one method, for example, would be it would take all the reports about the flavor profile of this ice cream, follow an algorithm, number crunch it, and come up with some rank ordering, right?
That tells us which ice cream is most popular, not which one is best.
Well, and yeah, so notice there's always this issue. Another way would be it could do chemical analyses and say the one that everyone agrees is best, which brings to the same problem, right, has this following chemical breakdown, and this is how yours is different or the same, right?
It may not be able to address the fact that if you insert cinnamon in the process at one point, that it actually somehow solves a problem that in flavor and what we're looking at. And we're getting close to running out of time, so I want to just go into, okay, Larry, we're getting a little short on time, but you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. One quick philosophical statement and then one quick question. Richard Pryor said, don't be in any hurry to die, because once you're dead, you're going to be dead a long time.
Okay.
With AI, what about a sense of humor?
Oh, good point.
I'm going to hang up now, okay, and I'll let you guys talk.
Okay, thanks. Okay. We've just got a couple of minutes. There, a sense of humor becomes I'm glad he brought it up, and I'm sorry we didn't.
Yeah, there are some AIs that have written jokes, that have sort of taken a stab at writing jokes. And I think that that's interesting, because what it requires us to do is to map the landscape of the things that humans find humorous. So if we need to train an AI to write jokes for us, we first have to tell it what kinds of things human beings find funny. So, you know, puns or turns of phrase or something like that. And yeah, if you go Google it, you can find some jokes that were written by AIs.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So someone might like Richard Pryor. Someone might like Whoopi Goldberg. Someone might like Bob Newhart.
Mm-hmm.
But they may not all work for the same person.
All right.
That may be the dilemma we have to leave with. Okay. As most of our listeners know, when we get towards the end of the program, I do a reasonably good job of getting out of the way and giving you both an opportunity to make sure that whatever I left off the table gets addressed, or at least pointed at with amusement that it wasn't even talked about. And Ryan, I'll give you first shot.
Sure. Thanks.
I wanted Keith to have the better last word.
Never mind. Okay. I resent that. So, you know, as Keith mentioned earlier, the reason that we invent technologies is to make human life easier and better. And we're doing that once again with artificial intelligence. But if there's one recurring story throughout the history of technology, it's been a failure to fully predict and fully appreciate the consequences of the things that we create. So if there's one message that I would leave people with, it's that the advances that we've seen in artificial intelligence lately and some of the missteps that we've seen really underscore the urgency and the seriousness of looking very carefully at the ethics and the moral foundations of the decisions that we make. And this is clearly the case in artificial intelligence, especially as we hand off more and more important decisions to artificially intelligent systems. And we don't even need to project out a world where they're doing all of our thinking or all of our working for us. But we already have a world where artificial intelligence is making decisions about our financial opportunities or our ability to get hired, whether we get a bank loan. They're making medical diagnoses. You know, they're not just mundane things like checking our spelling and giving us directions. So I think that this is a place where society has a lot of serious thinking to do about the way that these systems are built and what kind of checks and guarantees we build into them and what kinds of ethical guardrails we want to explore and guarantee throughout the entire process. Otherwise, we might be in a situation a couple of years from now that we very much regret, because there's not going to be any putting the genie back in the bottle.
Yeah, good point. We've got to figure out where the runaway train is and pay attention to it. Thank you. Okay. Keith.
Yeah, following up on that. In general, we have this problem that science fiction, and by the way, I'm a huge science fiction fan, but science fiction often portrays AI killing us all. Not likely in the short term. The real risk is that AI becomes, frankly, more competent, better at achieving cognitive goals, and we begin to trust it more and more and more along the lines of what Ryan was already hinting at. And then we forget that while it's achieving cognitive goals, it does so in a way different than we do. And so we begin to overtrust it, right? It's competent, but not competent across the board. We then start to say, we'll give it permission to do things that vastly affect us when we don't really understand how it's making those decisions, the so-called black box problem. And because it's not making them the same way we do, right, even though it's coming out with answers that up to a certain point we really like, right, that are really useful for us, we start to trust it, well, when we shouldn't, right? Okay, so our autonomous vehicle can get me to the grocery store 100 times out of 100, right? So let me have it drive across the Mojave Desert. Well, no guarantee that a human that can do that, that the same will apply to an autonomous vehicle. And this goes across the board for all the various kinds of AIs. We will also undertrust it at times, not trust it when we should, right? But the more pernicious problem is that we will overtrust it. We'll trust it when we shouldn't, right? And huge problems may arise when we don't think through these consequences in advance, when we don't do what is called anticipatory ethics. So a lot of what Ryan and I try to do is avoid what's called the first generation problem. If we think about this and the philosophical assumptions we make and the likely consequences and the ways in which we don't anticipate them, maybe we can avoid some first generation suffering, even dying, before we figure out how to fix the technology that we already foolishly adopted.
Yeah. Thank you. That's a good, for both of you, this is a good example of why I find philosophy far more fascinating than pure science, even though I probably spend more time paying attention to pure science and scratching my head about it. But I thank you very much for being with us. This has been a wonderful program. Thank you. This is Central Coast Voices. I'm appreciating of you all being with us to listen today. Chris Kington Barker will be with you next week. We haven't finalized all the details of her program. I'll be back with you in 2 weeks. And we're glad that you're with us and glad you took part in the discussion with us. Hope you enjoyed this and found philosophy, not just pure science, but a lot of fun. This program, as I've told you before, is produced by Action for Healthy Communities, a project of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County, along with KCBX. You can reach us at action@kcbx.org if you have any suggestions or feedback on the program. And thank you again to my guests, Dr. Ryan Jenkins and Keith Abney, for being part of this discussion. I would highly recommend that you Google both of these guys, because both their writing and some of their commentary on YouTube is fascinating, and that will continue the discussion. This has been Central Coast Voices. Thank you for joining us.